what made this country great economically? Geography was certainly an asset. The people were willing, but there was a problem. In the early 1800s, they were all separated by wide distances requiring arduous travel.
As in every period of crisis in the economic growth of America, men of enterprise and foresight arose to meet the challenge. They built the railroads, a new form of transportation that saw shining rails supplant the torturous trails of the wagon train. The railroad reached into every corner of the land. It provided a growing America with a spark to light the torch of progress.
That beacon of progress was enabled by the declaration of the railroads as a common carrier. We talked about the importance of that issue in the creation of the Internet and the debate over whether to think of high-speed Internet service as a kind of 21st century railroad. But in the 1800s, the common carrier railroads treated all customers equally, offered the opportunity to create businesses and get products to market through this new network of distribution across rails and roads and eventually telephone lines. It set the stage for massive transformations in the global economy. Edmund Phelps, economics professor at Columbia University and winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Economics, thinks it is these conditions that we must seek to replicate when we want to think about 21st century prosperity. To grasp innovation, look back, not forward, he says. Phelps' most recent book is Mass Flourishing. Professor Edmund Phelps, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So one of the things that you raise in this book, and there are many, many things that you raise in this book, is that the U.S. economy today is so much different from the conditions, the initial conditions in the 1800s, which really set the stage for the extraordinary success that political leaders are always touting. Describe the differences you see between now and, say, the 1870s, 1880s.
I think the 1800s were a fantastic time. My image of the mercantile capitalism that came before that is the lonely shepherd who doesn't have anything mental to do and doesn't have any people to talk with about his work, not that he would probably want to. And then suddenly in the 19th century, you have people coming together in cities and working together in factories and offices in companies. And the whole character of work is completely transformed. I think the distinctive emphasis of my book is on tinkering and imagining new products to produce or utterly new ways to produce a product. This was the birth of innovation in the world.
You say that really since 1964, the U.S. has been in a slow decline of that set of processes, that basically that everybody kind of tinkering in the middle and on the fringe has really given way to a sort of almost a mindless capitalism of work to companies and not necessarily everybody thinking in terms of what's the next problem that I can solve.
Yeah, that would be a simple way of putting it. But of course, we know that there are still pockets of considerable innovation in the American economy. We are still the innovation nation, but we're only a pale shadow of what we once were. And coming back to the pockets, there are incredible companies like Google out there. But the aggregate rate of innovation as measured by its impact on productivity, that aggregate rate of innovation is much, much smaller than the country had between the 1820s and 1940 or even 1960.
How do we get Americans to have more of a stake in this kind of innovation mentality in the sense that we always describe growth in terms of people getting jobs and making wages when in fact the most robust economy comes from when people are in the mix competing with each other, not necessarily purely thinking in terms of a job, but thinking in terms of what can I do to add to the economy, to the society, to the community, direct engagement.
Well, I think we have a teaching job to do. I think we have to explain to young people that business is not just some sort of getting through the day by solving the problems of the day. It's an opportunity to exercise creativity and imagination. So I think if we can get that message across, that don't just look for a 9-to-5 job that will not engage your imagination, look for opportunities to do those things, that would be a huge step. And I think my sense that I convey toward the end of the book is that traditional attitudes of the importance of sticking with your friends, the importance of not going too far from home, I think those are making it harder for young people to want to go west, young man, which was Horace Greeley's advice in the 19th century.
Which became, one word for you, plastics in the 1960s. And certainly, the internet economy, the digital economy, the high-tech economy has, echoed those precise go west, young man or woman forces. Economists, spend their life looking at numbers often, spend their life predicting trends and looking at kind of macro forces and other things. I'm wondering if the power of individual enterprise surprised you as an economist, that after looking at so many sort of macro, long-term economic events, that in many ways the conclusion of mass flourishing comes down to the collective power of a lot of people acting
right.
like, smart Thomas Edisons in places all over the world.
Everybody, figuratively speaking, was tinkering and thinking about how to do things better or is there a new product that we could produce? That was so powerful. Compare that with sort of a royalist, monarchical economy in which there's one thinker who's carrying the whole economy on his or her shoulders. That's just not powerful. That you'll be lucky if you get one or two or three ideas from that person. But when everybody is thinking about it, when there's a great spirit of novelty and exploration and discovery, things are very different.
So we cast the inventors of today, the people with the fabulous new idea, as crackpots and fringe characters at our peril culturally in this economy.
Right. Yeah, they're the goal. That's the energy that we need. That's the source that creates jobs and creates productivity growth, but also, above all, makes the workplace an interesting place to be.
Do you see the conditions of 1870, 1880 in the United States replicated today in a nation? Is it over for the United States? Has the torch been passed?
I very much hope that it's not over. The beginning of getting back to that dynamism led to so much innovation. The trick to getting back is to understand how it came about in the 19th century. We got to understand what it is that we want to recapture.
Other than just wealth.
We
want to capture an experience.
Yeah.
And a sense of collective mission.
Right.
Edmund Phelps is economics professor at Columbia University, winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Economics. His most recent book is Mass Flourishing. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.